Good afternoon. So hopefully you're here for CS4414 operating systems. I'm going to start by going over a few logistical things. So lectures, there are recordings of lectures that should be available sometime afterwards on the schedule page on the website. If you aren't watching live, either now or in the future, I recommend writing down questions so you actually remember to ask them. Ask in Piazza, office hours, etc. There's a course webpage. It's linked off Colab. It has pretty much all the information for the course, assignments, schedule, lecture slides, office hours, etc. There are office hours. We'll do some sort of mix of office hours via remotely via Discord and in person. We'll have a calendar on the website to indicate when those are. That calendar isn't really filled out now because I and my TAs are still figuring out our schedules. Discord office hours, we'll use an online queue on a website. In-person office hours, may or may not use that queue depending on whether we have like a convenient board and how busy things are. There are going to be homework assignments, which are programming assignments. They are mostly in C or C++. I expect to have one in Python. They are 1 to 2 weeks long. 2 week versions will have a checkpoint that's due in the middle, primarily because I have found that if I give a 2 week assignment and say, "No, really, it's twice as much work as a 1 week assignment," people do not treat it that way. Generally, the 2 week assignments are worth more, and most of the points are in the final submission, not in the checkpoint submission. Some of these assignments are going to use XV6, which is a teaching operating system. So this is a simplified OS based on Unix 6th edition, which is available in book form in the original version. It's available in book form, the actual printout of the source code. And before it was available in book form, it was apparently passed around through illicit photocopies. And some people at MIT decided that they would make a teaching OS based on this, where basically they took the same design and ported it to a more modern system. The original Unix 6th edition was built for the PDP-11. XV6, the version we'll be using, is built for 32-bit x86. And theoretically would actually boot on the 32-bit x86 system, though we're not going to do that. We're going to use an emulator because that's easier to develop on and easier to debug on. There's also, you might find online, a more recent RISC-V version. We're using the 32-bit x86 version, but it's less recent because theoretically you've seen from 2150 x86 assembly, so the little bits of assembly, most of XV6 is not assembly, but little pieces of it are, they're going to be easier to explain if you've seen x86 assembly than if we use the RISC-V version, in which case we'd have to also discuss how RISC-V assembly works a bit. There are going to be some quizzes, online quizzes after each week of lecture starting after next week. Same interface as 3330, no time limit, which I guess I should remove because I haven't done that for a while. Open book, open notes, open compiler, open internet. Just don't get help from other people. You can ask TAs questions about topics on the quiz, but we're not going to answer like the answer to the quiz question. So on, I'm expecting to have a final exam. My current plan, subject to change, is take home 24 hours overlapping the official final time, which is a combined slot for both sections at 7 p.m. that is on the final schedule, so you aren't surprised. This might change later. I think I don't want to do an in-person exam because that didn't work out so well last semester. So this is my current plan. I think I still want to have something at the end of the semester to sort of have that sort of coverage. There's a late policy. It's on the website. You might find it helpful to know about if you might want to submit assignments late. There is no required textbook. There is a recommended textbook, which is Anderson and Dahlin, Operating Systems Principles and Practice, which looks like this. There's also an sort of optional alternate textbook, which is Arpeggi da Su, Operating System 3 Easy Pieces, which is notably available from the authors in PDF form online for free. There's some topics we'll cover which are only in this book. Generally, I find for most topics, I think Anderson Dahlin is probably easier to read. Our Fantasy.2 is often very terse, which maybe is good, because it's less to read, but I think it's probably harder to understand. My lecture slides are more often based on what's in Anderson Dahlin than Fantasy.2, but they're both fine resources that you might want to refer to. And some notes on academic honesty. So homeworks are individual. They're not group assignments. No code from prior semesters, other than your own code, of course. No sharing code, pseudocode, detailed descriptions of code with students, please. And no using code from the internet, but the reason I have this slide primarily is because there are some exceptions for things that aren't the point of the assignment. So for example, we're gonna have an assignment later in the semester to write a shell. A shell is the sort of program that implements the command line you're used to, where you type a command and it runs a program. The main objective of that assignment is like the logic around running programs and so on. So code that's not related to that sort of main objective, for example, code that like splits a string into pieces, that I'm okay with you copying from somewhere as long as you make it clearly cited. If I look at your code and I say, that doesn't look like your code, you know, I should see why without having to like do some searching. And if you're not clear whether something is sort of not clearly the point of the assignment, ask us. But I don't intend you to like re-implement string parsing and things like that on assignments which clearly aren't about string parsing, you know, or math and so on. But obviously, like if you find a shell online, don't copy it. But if you find a split string routine, that's fine. Because this is not a class about how you split strings efficiently. That's something you theoretically learned elsewhere, and in practice you probably use someone else's code for that, which already figured it out. On the quizzes, I mentioned are individual. Don't share answers. They're open book, open notes, but don't share answers. Don't IM people for answers. Don't ask the question on Stack Overflow or some other site like that. Now, for getting help, you can ask on Piazza. You can ask at office hours. Generally, for example, for quizzes, we're not gonna give you the answer to the quiz questions, but you can ask about the topic of the quiz and so on, and TAs are responsible for not giving away answers primarily. You can also email me if you none of these work, but that's probably the least preferable option. So that's on logistics. So questions, comments about logistics? Okay. Don't see any. Okay. So this is a course on operating systems. So it might be nice to know what an operating system is. And for better or worse, there is some ambiguity about that. There's different exact definitions. And you can get into a lot of debates on, is something part of the operating system, or just a program or library that happens to be running upon that operating system? So for example, there's some code which lets me move windows around on a screen. Is that part of the operating system? It depends who you ask. Some people will say, of course it is. That's operating system functionality there. It's not a program you're running. So you'll say, no, it's just a program that you happen to be running that happened to ship with your machine. Is code that supports printers, is that part of the operating system? Well, of course it is. It's an output device. And some people will say, well, no. That's just some separate program. It's not really a core feature of the OS. We're not going to resolve these questions of, are these part of the OS? We're just going to skip them. We don't really care. We're going to give general principles, and you know, we're going to implement things that are, you know, common things that are operating system-like in assignments and talk about how those work without being too concerned about whether it's really part of the operating system or not. So let's go sort of give more general principles. And one way to think about what an operating system is think of, well, what's operating? And historically, there was a job called a computer operator. Here's a photo from the National Library of Medicine at the National Institutes of Health of some of their computer operators a while ago. And you know, this was a job where you would have to, like, load programs, run programs, and so on. Like, things that maybe the operating system has automated a large part of. That used to be things that you'd have to do more manually, that someone would have to do that was operating the machine. So that's sort of one way of viewing sort of the high level, you know, idea of what is an operating system. Well, it's like many programs, it's automating something, and it's automating this what used to be a manual task of like loading programs, loading files, and so on, that you might have had to do, you know, in a less elegant way on these older, less featureful machines. Now, our textbooks have some definitions, and these two definitions might at first seem very different. So, Anderson Dahlin says an operating system manages a computer's resources. So resources, by that Anderson Dahlin means like the processor, the memory, the input and output devices. And Arpeggio Dassault, they aren't concerned with actually talking about processor, input output devices, and so on in the definition. That's not a part of it. They say that an operating system provides a virtual machine. We'll talk about, wait, virtual machine? So operating systems like VirtualBox? Well, not quite. We'll talk about why we're using that term. But it provides a virtual machine that's more convenient than the real machine. That's a machine that's better than the real machine in some way. And these are not contradictory. They're just different emphases. And the common theme is that we're getting something that's somehow a better interface, something better to use than just using the machine directly. Like, we could imagine that the hardware provides something that lets us make programs that work, and we could use that directly. Why are we using this other thing on top of that? And that's because it's going to be better than if we were using the machine directly. And the reason it's going to be better is that the operating system is going to do some things for us. And Anderson Dahlin has this sort of taxonomy where they divide the things the operating system does into these three categories. They have one category we call that the operating system's a referee. So it allows resource sharing. So it lets, you know, we have multiple things we want to run, multiple people, maybe we want to use a machine. It lets them share the resources of the machine in some way. And it provides what we call protection, by which we mean that a program can't interfere with other programs or the OS. Either by accident, like if you write a program that like goes off the end of an array, that doesn't end up, you know, crashing your entire system generally. That's a form of protection. Or if you write a malicious program, there's things that program still can't do. They also have this illusionist rule that part of the operating system's job is to provide good abstractions, things that are convenient to program against, clean and easy. And this third role of that the OS is glue, that there's these services that lots of programs need and the operating system is going to implement them. So one example is storage, that we think of storage as like files. And well, we could imagine every program implementing like how directories work, but we probably don't want to do that. We probably want to have one implementation of directories and have every program use it, rather than have, you know, your word processor have an implementation of how directories work, and, you know, your web browser have an implementation of how directories work. You want one common thing. The OS is going to provide that sort of glue that multiple programs want to use. So we have these sort of high-level rules. Let's do a little exercise here. So let's start with, let's say, you know, so you, as either someone who's written programs that run in an operating system or use an operating system that runs programs, so give, what are some examples? Let's start with the first one where you've experienced, you know, evidence of how the OS is fulfilling that resource sharing, that referee role. Someone give me an example. Yes. Yeah, so, okay, so can't delete files that are in use. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Task scheduling. So, can you be more specific? So do you mean like setting up something to run in the future? Okay, so I would say if we're talking about like an interface where you can say run something at 2 p.m., I'd call that glue, a common service. If we're talking about running multiple things at once, I'd call that the referee rule. Yes?
In addition to, like, if you're going to like open something that's going to take up too much memory, it'll like stop you.
Okay, so something that uses too much memory crashes, right, is what you're saying?
Yeah, or it'll warn you.
That uses too much memory, you know, crashes only itself. So that's an example of the referee and protection rules. Yeah?
Defines what users and applications are kind of supposed to see.
Defines what users, okay, so one user, you can't see everything,
you
other user stuff.
Can't see others, users' files, yeah. And applications.
Yeah, can't see other users' stuff, user applications, things. Okay. Yeah.
You're not allowed to have duplicate file names in the same
unique file names or. Yeah. File names. Okay. Yeah.
After updating an application, it can prevent you from like opening it up or using the updated version.
Okay, so so this is sort of, you know, special behavior for updating a file in use. Yeah, so, you know, so updating applications in use doesn't break the application. Yeah, doesn't break. Okay, so that's a bunch of things on the referee side of things. Let's talk about the illusionist side. What are some examples of, or question first, or no? Okay, so what are some examples for the illusionist side? I'll try to get, yeah. Sorry? Okay, so GUI command line, maybe, okay. I'm a little iffy on that, but I see the argument, yeah. There? Yeah. Virtual memory. So, what's the abstraction?
It's preventing programs from having to deal with like physical addresses.
Okay. So, don't use physical addresses. Okay. Yeah.
So, you can use shell commands to perform different actions as opposed to like editing like raw binary.
So you're talking about, you can use shell commands to perform different actions. So I agree that that's an abstraction, though I think there's sort of, you know, sort of shell commands to edit files. But I think a better example of, like a more fundamental part of this is that files are one of these abstractions. So like a hard drive or a solid state disk is not organized in files. That's something the operating system is doing on top of a simpler interface, which we'll talk about much later in the semester. Yeah?
Running multiple programs concurrently,
following that? Sure. So multiple programs. Running at the same time on one core. Yeah.
Expose an interface for doing various things, such as, well, anything in Cisco, but various things such as, you know, connecting to networking or opening a file, closing a file, really anything in Cisco.
So, okay, so sort of device access. Yeah, I prefer anything. Yeah, back there. Or, system drivers. So I wouldn't say device drivers are the abstraction. So the abstraction is the interface that we have for device drivers, which for the OS we care about is like files, right? So you have an interface for the devices. So the arguing device drivers are the illusionist role. So the illusionist role is about the interface, like providing a nice interface. Okay. So the device driver means that we have code to access a device. That's nice, but that doesn't tell us that the way we access that device is any actually different than how we do it if there wasn't an OS in the way. Right. The thing that makes it the illusionist role is that generally, for example, accessing the screen through the OS is a lot more convenient than it would be if the OS wasn't there. Right, you can like print out characters and you don't have to worry about a lot of details that are part of how the screen works with the OS. Sort of device access, which is like with file-like interface usually. I think that's enough examples. We'll go through more over the semester. So other comments, questions? Yeah.
Question about program execution and termination, would that be an abstraction?
So program execution and termination, would that be an abstraction? Yes. So starting and stopping programs, that's sort of an abstraction because that's not really a fundamental, like the operations that exist in the real hardware is like jumping somewhere, which is not what like starting a new program does. Yeah.
Would directories be an abstraction?
Would directories be an abstraction? Yes. Yeah.
Something like ensuring baseline human readability with something like a consistent refresh rate, would that be an abstraction?
Would managing the display to have a consistent refresh rate be an abstraction?
Like talking to the monitor.
So no, I wouldn't say that's an abstraction. An abstraction would be like, what's the interface programs have to the monitor? Right. So it's something else we're doing that might be useful as far as like deciding how we use the monitor. But the abstraction part is how do programs access the monitor?
Would
the task manager interface be an abstraction? So a big abstraction, and one we'll talk about a bunch, is the idea of a process. So the fact that your task manager, if you've seen that in Windows or whatever the system monitor and OS X is called, which like list all the running programs, like those programs, like they aren't a fundamental entity in the machine. So there's some process abstraction. Yes, and that's the primary abstraction we'll be concerned with for our first 2 weeks of class. So we have these views of what OSs do, and let's go back to this idea of a virtual machine. And we can view from sort of our PHYSO's point of view that we have this virtual machine interface that applications have with the operating system, which has all these cleaner abstractions like files, directories, devices we open and close like files, and processes and threads. That's our virtual machine interface. That's the interface applications see. And the OSs have this physical machine interface, which is usually more complicated and or less featureful. And typically, when you've seen virtual machines in other classes, you're thinking of virtual machines like VirtualBox, VMware, where we run an operating system. And it's really the same thing, except for the choice of what that interface is. So if we make the interface of that virtual machine like the interface for physical hardware, then we get something like VirtualBox, where we're running an operating system that expects to be run on real hardware because we're providing it the interface of real hardware, maybe not the same real hardware we're actually running on, but some real hardware, so we run an operating system. If we choose instead an interface that's designed for running applications, we end up with what we'll call a process virtual machine. The process is the big abstraction we're talking about providing to programs. And that is more like what you've programmed against. That's the virtual machine you've seen is that process interface where you can start programs and write to a file and so on. That's that convenient interface. And there's this kind of spectrum here. And we're going to be talking mostly about implementing the process virtual machine abstractions. But some of the same concepts apply to the system virtual machine. And you may have noticed I kind of drew this as a long line, implying that there's points in between. And, you can decide when you're implementing something like VirtualBox, do we implement like actual hardware interface, or do we add things to make it more convenient? And most things like VirtualBox and VMware have actually chosen a point which is not all the way over at the imitate real hardware end of the spectrum, but somewhere a little further to our right. But we're going to mostly be concerned with typical operating systems that are in the process virtual machine space. We might spend a little bit of time talking about how system virtual machines work, but we're mostly concerned with these interfaces which really are going to be chosen for application convenience. So questions about this sort of spectrum? Yeah. So the question is the JVM, where would it fall on this? So it's more like a process virtual machine. So if we're talking about implementing like a completely different instruction set, maybe I don't think this sort of dichotomy works very well, which is what the JVM does. But it's definitely like things chosen to be convenient to program against. Yeah. Question, why would you use a system virtual machine? So the main, so I guess there's two, so question, why would you use a system virtual machine? So there's one obvious reason is you already have code written to run on real hardware. System virtual machine is going to be more easier to run that on. Another reason is that we have this OS design philosophy that this process virtual machine sort of illustrates of we're going to make it really convenient for at the OS level to write applications. So the OS is going to be very big and complicated. And you might say, well, applications, they could just have libraries that handle all that complicated stuff. They could choose a library to use, and maybe we should provide a really simple interface. So that would be a case for why you might want a system virtual machine. That's not the type of OSs we're going to be talking about in this class, but that is a real proposal that many people have thought was a good idea in the research community, and there's some systems sort of implemented with that idea in mind. Yeah?
Does a regular computer have both of them or just one?
Question, can a regular computer have both of them or just one? So obviously you run VirtualBox on what looks like a machine that runs processes. So typically the way this works is that a program like VirtualBox manages to get hooks to sort of provide a second virtual machine interface by like asking the OS to add some extra features. So it can run some code with a different virtual machine interface. By installing some extra code in the OS. Yeah. So question, isn't VirtualBox just an application itself? So as you would almost always end up using VirtualBox, the answer is no. So typically there are some components of VirtualBox which are involve a little bit of code in what we could typically consider part of the operating system. As I mentioned, this is kind of a vague thing because what's the operating system is not a well-defined concept. But implementing something like VirtualBox usually needs some features supported by the OS that are not going to be in an OS typically just designed to run normal processes. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Does Docker fit anywhere on this spectrum, or is that completely different?
So does Docker fit on the spectrum, or is that different? That is different. And I don't know if we'll really get to that. But that's basically a different way of dividing up, doing resource sharing is the primary mechanism behind things like Docker or containers generally. Yes?
So every computer must have both interfaces.
Question, every computer must have both interfaces? So both the virtual and the physical machine interface? So every hardware has the physical machine interface. You could write code that uses only the physical machine interface where you don't have an abstracted interface. That's probably not something you're going to do in anything but sort of very specialized context, but you can absolutely do that. And for like, you know, if you're If you have a system with, you know, a kilobyte of memory, maybe you would prefer to do that. There are commercial computers with a kilobyte of memory. So if you're like implementing, you know, computer for some sort of physical device, you might get something that small. But for things that run programs in the traditional sense, you probably have these abstractions. So let's talk a bit about the abstractions in the process virtual machine. So we're going to have sort of these abstractions that represent the real hardware. So a real hardware, we have one or more processors that can run instructions and have registers. We're going to represent these as a thread, which is kind of our abstract, cleaner, nicer version of a processor. And we're going to provide features that the hardware definitely couldn't provide. Like, you can probably have lots and lots of threads, regardless of how many processors you have physically. And that's not really something the hardware can do for you by itself. We need to have some work to implement that abstraction. We're going to provide memory allocation. You're not going to have to worry about the layout of real memory. Just call malloc and you get some memory. So, you know, there's not going to be worries about the organization of memory, but on physical hardware, that's generally something that the hardware interface you would have to be concerned about. What place are you going to put this data? We're going to have files with this open, read, write, close interface. This is not the only way we could do things, but the sort of Unix OSs have decided that that's how we're going to talk to devices, be they, you know, parts of a disk, or things on the network, or, you know, keyboards and mice and screens. Is that we're going to have this interface where we open something, we read and write to it, and we close it. That's the same for all these different types of devices. Even though the actual hardware mechanism of implementing what happens on a read or write may be very, very different between different types of devices, we're going to have this single interface. And we're going to have this concept of a process. So a process is a combination of sort of two abstractions that give us the idea of the essential parts of a dedicated machine. So if we imagine, you know, it's a virtual machine, so what do we need in a machine that runs code? We need a processor, and we need memory. So we have our abstraction that represents a processor, which is a thread. So a thread is sort of an illusion of your own CPU. It looks like a CPU, and it has things that we expect a processor to have that are reserved for your program. Like, you have a program counter that says what instruction are you executing now, and it advances from one instruction to the next, just like you would executing on the physical hardware. And you have your own registers, your own stack pointer, and so on. So that's what a thread is, and a process will have one or more of those. That's going to be implemented somehow with real processors. We also have an address space, which is what we'll call the abstraction, which is the idea that you have your own memory that is independent of other programs, that you do things in your memory without caring about what other programs are running. You can just access it. We'll talk much later in the semester about the implementation of the address space abstraction. We'll start by talking a bit about how threads work. So this is sort of the big abstraction we're going to start by talking about. And the most important abstraction of a sort of typical general purpose OS. And so when we have that, we have these applications which are using these threads, address spaces, processes, file sockets. Those are the entities they see. And the operating system is going to map these to interrupts, to physical memory addresses, to special registers for communicating with devices, and so on. We'll talk about some of those things throughout the semester. And sort of the point of these abstractions is that from the application's point of view, you know, all you have to care about are these abstractions, that you're writing a program that uses files, not disks. You're writing a program that, you know, starts threads, it doesn't use processors, or it starts another process, it doesn't jump to a program and somehow make it work. And a nice aspect of this this abstractions here is that this is future-proof, that we can provide these same abstractions as the hardware interface changes because the hardware becomes more, you know, capable or works differently. And also, these interfaces are going to be much more featureful than real hardware. We had the example of, you know, you can have tons of threads, but the number of processors you actually have is going to be limited in a very real physical way. And if we think of these abstractions, these interfaces, the operating system's job in this view is just translating from one interface to another. That's just figuring out, if you're using a thread, how does that map to using a processor? If you're using a file, how does that map to actually using the hard drive? That is just a translation layer. Sometimes that translation is very complicated. But that's all it's doing, is just translating one way of talking about the machine to another. So if I have an application, it's going to be represented as a process. That's typically what we think of as a running program. It process is going to have a thread with some registers. And sometimes the operating system is going to implement that by mapping those registers to the actual registers of the processor. And it's also going to have some memory. And typically, we're going to implement that by assigning some portion of the memory to the address space the memory application has. And we can have multiple of these processes. And we can do the same mapping for all of them, except, well, we can't actually assign two of them to the processor at once. So what we'll do is we'll say, OK, so to implement the thread for process for application two, we'll just map its registers to the memory, because we don't have space in the processor right now, because it's in use. And at some point, when we actually want to execute code, we'll swap the two. Sort of this is, we'll talk about this in a lot more detail, how this works in XP6 later. This is called a context switch. This is sort of the central way we implement that thread abstraction. Yes?
How does it work then if you have a case of, like, say, like a multi-core CPU?
So the question is, how does this work with a multi-core CPU? So with a multi-core CPU, ideally, if we have two cores and two threads, we'd assign one thread to the first CPU and one thread to the other. But typically, we'll end up with a situation where we have like four cores and 17 threads, in which case we'll do the same swapping, and there's going to be a complicated choice of what do we put where.
But it could run multiple processes concurrently.
But we can run multiple threads concurrently, yes. Not concurrently, so multiple threads at the same time. So concurrently, we'll say that things are running concurrently often when this is in fact what's happening. So I'm going to be clear, distinguish that from running them actually at the same time, which we can do with multiple cores. Yes?
Can you explain the context switch thing again?
Can I explain the context switch thing again? So, sure. So application one was originally on the CPU, so its stack pointer was this processor's current stack pointer. But then we needed to do something so process application two could actually get work done. And to make let application two get work done, we need to make the stack pointer on the CPU be the stack pointer for application two. So to do that, the OS is going to somehow arrange, and we'll talk about the details of the mechanism later, to take the registers that are currently stored in the processor, register values, I should say, currently stored in the processor for application one, put them in memory, and put the ones for process application two on the processor so it can run. Does that answer your question?
What's the difference between that and computer architecture?
So this is the question is, in computer, in CS3330, we talked about context switches. These are the same context switches. I felt I needed to review them because people forget about them, and also I don't know what ECE students have seen. Yes?
So when we describe something, we see something like four speed threads, right? So threads mean like threads in general?
So the question is, so some processors are say they have more threads on the processor than cores. So what that is that the processor has some cores that can actually execute multiple streams of instructions at once. So a core on that processor, if it has four cores and 8 threads, a core in that processor would support 2 hardware threads, which are different than the software threads. And each hardware thread will have its own set of registers and its own program counter. So it's kind of the hardware implementing the thread abstraction the same way the OS does. And what will happen is the OS will map, using the same sort of swapping, it will map software threads to hardware threads, just like it maps, in this example, software threads to the processor. Like, so each of those threads will look to the OS like a processor. But what's actually happening in the hardware is typically that the hardware is using out-of-order execution techniques to interleave the instructions of the 2 threads, which is certainly not a topic we'll test you on. But if you vaguely remember, if you covered out-of-order execution before, it turns out that out-of-order execution makes it easy to run 2 streams of instructions from different programs at the same time, which is what some processors do to get more performance. Yes?
When you say processor, is that like the same thing as CPU?
When I say processor, is that the same thing as CPU? Yes, I probably should always use processor to be less confusing. Yes?
How do you decide which OS to use?
How do I decide which OS to use? I don't. We, for this class, are using a Unix-like OS because it was convenient and it's very common. Okay, so we have sort of running programs. The other thing is we need to access devices. And in the Unix model, every single device is going to appear as this file interface. So these files will map to disks, to network stuff, stuff on the network, to the monitor, to the keyboard or mouse. We'll just have files that an application has open or could have open. And we also have something that doesn't work so well in this sort of virtual machine view is how protection works. So like, if you access something that is not part of your address space, that if you access something that's not your memory, like, well, it's not really, doesn't say in the address space instruction what should happen, but sort of the protection guarantee that we're going to somehow implement is that, you know, it's not going to be something that's going to cause other programs to break. And typically, the way you see this is like if you access something out of bounds, you get a segmentation fault, you don't just end up writing to application 2's memory, for example. Even though from the abstraction point of view, it's kind of undefined what should happen if you go outside the memory we reserve for you, the memory that should be available to you. Okay, so here I've been talking kind of generally about sort of what operating systems do. We're going to be looking at a sort of case study at the Unix design, which has some choices that they made, which are not the choices every OS makes. This is sort of the classic Unix design. So we have applications, and applications generally interact with the hardware through a bunch of standard libraries and standard programs. And those interact with some component we call the kernel through a system call interface we'll go into much more detail about sometime later. And the reason why things work this way is that, well, I have this box that looks like, oh, applications work directly with the hardware, and so does everything else, so why can't applications just do everything directly? And, well, this is not actually the way things are set up. Now, we kind of have 2 versions of the hardware interface. We have the kernel mode version, which has complete access, and we have the user mode version, which is more limited. So when your application's running, you know, and it's actually active on the processor, it does get direct access to the hardware, but that direct access doesn't include access to all the functionality of the processor. To get to that other functionality, you need to go through the system call interface to this component we call the kernel, which is what runs in kernel mode. It has that complete access to the functionality of the machine. So we have this limited interface. And I mentioned that it's not well defined what the OS is. So some people will tell you, oh, the OS is all this stuff. It's the kernel, It's the standard libraries, the utility programs, and that makes sense, right? Like, your machine is pretty useless without a program to let you log in or run a program, or without a library that implements, you know, any function whatsoever, you know, without code that calls main. But on the other hand, you know, you could replace one standard library with another and still have things work. That's in fact, you can in fact, like for example, for Linux, you can find multiple versions of the standard library that are completely independent of each other. And you could have replaced the kernel with another one. As long as you implement the same system goal interface, things will still work the same. So some people would say all this stuff is the OS. Some people would say only the kernel part is the OS. As I mentioned earlier, we're not really going to care. We're going to be interested in some things which are part of both of these. And also something about this is that I mentioned that this is the sort of Unix design. This is not the only way we could organize things. In the Unix design, we've chosen to actually put a lot of stuff in this kernel part. This is not necessary, but it is certainly convenient, and it is sort of one of the more common OS designs you see today. So we probably won't be able to have time to talk about some alternate designs, but you know, that's a choice that they made that makes things more convenient. But on the other hand, that means that this kernel component, you can see there's a lot of stuff in there. And it's very complicated. And maybe, you know, there's some alternatives which maybe avoid that. It might be more reliable or something like that. So questions about our overall Unix design? Yes. Can I go to the system call interface on this slide? This system call interface? What about it? Or can I explain? So the system call interface, so we'll talk about how, so we'll talk, I guess I'll get to that in a bit. So we need some way of accessing this extra functionality. So that's the interface for that is going to be called the system call interface. We'll go talk exactly how that looks in XV6 as a case study. But we need some special interface that can't be a normal function call because we have to enable the full functionality of the hardware somehow. So we can't just use a normal function call to do that. Okay. So one thing that this diagram kind of reveals is that the hardware typically implements functionality to help us write operating systems. One of these pieces of functionality is this idea of kernel mode versus user mode. And there's some other functionality we're going to talk about that the hardware also implements to help us write operating systems. This is not actually necessary. Like, we could write an operating system that provides the same functionality without this, but it certainly makes things more convenient. And pretty much every OS you've probably used or thought of using is kind of designed with a whole bunch of pieces of hardware functionality in mind, including this user kernel mode thing. So that there's operations that require this kernel mode, you know, that's how you get the full functionality of the hardware. And the OS is going to be able to control what runs in kernel mode so it can determine like how things talk to the keyboard, because it's the only one who lets code that does that run. It, you know, how things access, set up address spaces, and so on. So another important mechanism, so this is the mechanism we need to control access to devices. We also need to control access to memory. So we need to not just determine what instructions run, but what memory is accessed. And the hardware mechanism we'll have for that is some sort of address translation. That addresses a program uses will be translated to real memory addresses in a way set by the OS. We'll talk in much, much more detail how this works later. If you may remember virtual memory, some from prior class, which is the modern mechanism for this, but not the only possible one. And basically, this lets us control what memory you can access. And the combination of this user mode and this address translation lets us do things where we just run an application directly on the machine without any extra work, because it's in user mode, so it can't do anything to you know, special instructions or anything like that, and it has this limited set of memory it can access. Therefore, you know, we can actually just jump to it and run it and not be concerned that we're going to break our protection promises, that, you know, like, the program will interfere with other things and so on. So if we didn't have that, it would still be possible to make an OS, but it would be a lot, look a lot different. So there have been OSs proposed that way. So an example of what you could do is you can, like, say all programs are going to be written in the JVM, and we can guarantee that when you run JVM things that they don't access hardware resources they're not supposed to. No. But that's a very different OS design than what we're used to. We're going to talk about OSs that use this hardware functionality, because pretty much everyone does that. So another piece of hardware functionality we need is that when we jump to a program and just run it directly on the hardware, we need to stop it sometimes. That, like, if we press a key, I want to manage that key press somehow. If the program runs for too long, I want to stop it. So we need some help from the hardware to allow us to do that, because if the program is just running directly on that user mode hardware interface, it can just keep running a loop, it seems like. We need some additional feature that's going to let the OS interrupt these programs. That mechanism is going to be called exceptions. So this is hardware support to start the CPU running the OS code instead of the application code when some sort of event happens. And there's a whole lot of events that are going to qualify. And this exception mechanism is also how we're going to handle the transition from user to kernel mode. So this exception is going to be the only way we transition from user to kernel mode, which means that that system call interface is going to involve exceptions. But also exceptions are going to occur for other reasons, like key presses and other things the OS needs to handle. And because the OS always gets run when an exception happens, and that's the only way to start kernel mode, that's how the OS controls what runs in kernel mode, by making sure it doesn't, you know, accidentally run, you know, jump from the thing code that runs on an exception to somewhere without switching back to user mode. So questions on, do you have exceptions, how they work with dual mode operation? Okay.
So that there's different ways aside from just using virtual mappers for, like, virtual memory?
So question, I said there's different ways of implementing address, of doing address translation besides virtual memory? Yes. Can I give an example? So a simple example is that we can, is a scheme called base and bound, which is described in our textbook, where the mapping is add something and check if it's not greater than a limit, rather than the page table version of that thing that we have in virtual memory. So that's a much simpler scheme, but it's a lot less useful for the OS. But there need, you know, there's one option we've seen we see all the time, but it's not the only thing hardware can implement, and we could imagine places where we might prefer a simpler mechanism or a different complicated mechanism from the perspective of what's better for the hardware implemented, what's going to be more efficient for our OS, and so on. Question, yes? Yeah. Question is, do we start running an OS and as soon as the exception happens? Yes. So an exception is the event that starts running the OS, yeah.
Okay, so, like, this is kind of like a function that has from the compartment. But, like, is the OS, all exception handling events, is that, like, part of the OS?
Question is, all the exception handling code part of the OS? Yes, and this is probably one of the few things which people would almost always agree is part of the OS. Might be a few exceptions, but almost always people will say that's part of the OS, even though I said the definition of OS is murky. Other questions? Okay, so if you remember 3330, we had a bunch of terms for exceptions. And this is useful to know from the perspective of knowing what are different things that trigger this event where we need to run the OS. So one is external events, like a timer goes off, so that's how we enforce that programs don't run too long, or I like press a key, or the network has some data coming in. So those are called, we call them 3030 interrupts. There's also things when the program does something bad, like if the program accesses invalid memory, that's a fault, or if like we divide by zero, the OS needs to handle that. But there are also exceptions which are triggered by program actions. So those are our system call interfaces, that if I want to write to a file, I can't do that myself in user mode. I do not have access to the device that implements the file. So I'm going to trigger an exception deliberately, which we'll call a system call, to make that happen. And in 3030, we briefly mentioned this last category that are the 3030 textbook called aborts, which is if something in the hardware breaks. Like if my memory is broken, the hardware wants to inform the OS so the OS can try to do something maybe, or at least display a message. And so there's this last category for that. So I think these categories are useful for thinking about, oh, there's lots of different reasons we can have exceptions. These are all things where the same thing the hardware needs to do is basically the same. We want to run the OS and have the OS figure out what to do. The program divided by zero, what do you want to do about that program? You know, the hardware doesn't have a good idea. The OS, you know, can do something useful like run a different program instead. If a key press happens, the OS is managing how the keyboard is shared between different programs, so it's going to handle that and so on. Well, there's a problem with this terminology, and I mentioned it briefly in 3030, is that everyone uses different terminology, and XV6 is no exception. So in XV6, everything, every kind of exception is called a trap. And sometimes an interrupt, depending on what part of XV6 you're reading. There's no real distinction in name about the different causes, but there are a lot of different causes. But they call them all traps, probably because I would guess the PDP-11 called them traps. They sometimes call them interrupts, because if you read the Intel manuals, they're all called interrupts. But the name doesn't actually tell you the type, but I'd like you to be aware, oh, there's lots of reasons exceptions can happen. Lots of them. So questions about our different reasons for exceptions. Okay. So let's go back to this idea we mentioned, system calls, that you have a whole bunch of things that programs can't do themselves. They can't allocate memory themselves because that involves changing their address space, changing that address translation mapping. They can't read or write to a file, you know, file on disk, that would involve communicating with the hard drive, they can't read from the keyboard directly. So these are all things where the program can't do it themselves because it needs kernel mode instructions. It needs that full access to the hardware. So we need to run code in kernel mode, and we're going to do that by triggering an exception. And generally, we're going to have some code run that deliberately runs and it triggers an exception. And the OS's exception handler for that is going to know, because we've made an agreement in advance, that, oh, when you see that exception, that means the program's requesting you do something, and therefore it's going to do it. And there's some convention, just like a calling convention, where the OS decides, oh, this is how the requests are going to be come in. That's why I know it's a request and not like the program crashing or something like that. Okay, so since we've talked about a bunch of different causes of exceptions, let's do a little exercise. So let's say I have a single core OS. We have three processes that are active, A, B, and C. We're already running process A. It prompts for input. Then it waits to read a key press, and while it is waiting, the OS decides to run B and C, B then C, and then a key press happens and the OS switches to A. A does something with that key press and then exits. The question is, how many exceptions happen throughout this process? I'll give you a bit of time, you can talk with your neighbors.
Thank you.
Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, not people. Okay, so who thinks we need more than 10 exceptions? Okay, 10 or less? 9 or less? 8 or less? 7 or less? 6 or less? 5 or less? 4 or less? 3 or less? Okay. 2 or less? 1 or less? Okay. So it seems like around 4 is our consensus number. Let me go through, which is about what I expect. So we're already running A, and we prompt for input. So this is probably a system call to write to the screen or the network or however we write our prompt. So that should be at least 1. And then we need to wait to read a key press, and that's probably another system call. So that's probably 2. Now, some of you might reasonably say, wait, we're asking the OS to do 2 different things right after each other. Couldn't we just have that be 1 system call? And the answer is yes, but we need to have a mechanism to request to write something and read, which is typically not something an OS is going to implement. We could, and maybe there probably are some OSs which do look like that, but it's not very common. It's not a traditional Unix-like design. So probably not combined, so we, you know, could be 1 syscall, but unlikely. What's more likely is that the program will say, write this to the screen, then the OS will go back to the program, and the program will say, oh, now run some code, and then that code will ask the OS to read something. It's much more likely, but yes, we could imagine an OS which provides a way of requesting to do the write and the read at once. It's just not very, very uncommon. So, there we go. And then we're waiting to read a key press, and the OS runs B, and then it has to switch from B to C. So that's going to require some sort of exception to happen. Now, we don't know exactly why it switched from B to C, but we know an exception needs to happen because we need to access data for program C while B is running. We can't do that without being in kernel mode, or if we could, that means that program B can mess up program C's stuff, which shouldn't be allowed. So there has to be an exception there, which is our, should be 3. And then for the OS to switch to A, we need to have another exception. So I got a minimum of 4 so far. And then we have one last one. A needs to exit. That's going to be another exception, because when we exit, something else needs to happen besides running A. A can't run other, switch to another program or whatever itself. It needs the OS's help for that. And that's most likely going to be a system call. Now, this is kind of a lower bound. We could imagine it wouldn't be uncommon for, say, writing the input. Maybe we do that. We ask to write character by character instead of writing all at once. So maybe that's more than one system call. You know, maybe we do something that involves more system calls for reading. Or maybe program B runs a bunch of system calls or has other events that happen that require exceptions. So this is kind of a lower bound of 5. So we have 5 plus. So questions on that? Yes. So when did the key press happening after C be exception? Yeah, that's the exception 4. I guess it probably should mark that it's that the key press triggers the exception. We know the exception actually happened because the OS ran. So that's why I put it above the OS switches. Yes, back there. Yeah. This question is, when A waits to read for a key press, does it include switch for B? Yes, because the OS is already running in kernel mode. There's no need to do anything else. And the OS needs to decide, what do I do next? And that what I do next decision is going to be, well, I don't want to run A, so I'm going to run B. So, yes. The question, wouldn't there be an exception happening between when the key press happens and the OS switches back to A, you mean?
Yes.
That's why I wrote the word immediately. There absolutely could be, but the assumption of this question is that the OS really switches as soon as it can.
Oh, okay.
But absolutely the OS could, and in practice often will, just wait a while afterwards. And there.
Exception defined as the number of times the OS does something, or is it defined as the number of times the OS?
Question, is the exception defined as the number of times the OS does something or something else? The exception is when the hardware jumps to some OS code. So that's how many times does that happen? So it turns out that sometimes when the hardware does that, the OS does multiple things, like when it sets up A to wait for the key press and switches to B. But that happens with one action of the hardware to trigger that. Does that answer your question? And yes, you. What do I have next to 5? Syscall. Sorry, I should try to make my handwriting slightly less bad. Is there an exception between switching from B to C? Yes. That's what the 3 is.
And so number 3 isn't just waiting for the call.
So question number 3 isn't part of waiting for the call for the key press. It is not. It is. So we don't have an exception. So when A waits, the OS needs to say, what do I? So, okay, I've recorded that A needs to wait, and the OS needs to decide what to run next. And it's not going to run A next, so it has to run something else, and in this case, it decided to run B. Does that answer your question?
So
the running B is part of A waiting to read for the key press. Okay, yes.
So, what do you mean
So, question, what does it mean for A to wait to read the key press? So that means that the OS has somehow registered that when a key press happens, I want to tell A about it. And also that the OS has registered that A is not interested in running until it can get that key press. Does that answer your question? So it's asking the OS to do some bookkeeping and do something else while it waits.
So what I'm saying is,
question is, A is not really waiting, the OS is waiting. I would say the OS is waiting on behalf of A. And waiting, when your program waits, that means you're telling, asking the OS to not run it. That's what that is. Yes? Can I have two programs waiting for a key press at the same time? Yes, so the OS needs to make a single decision, though, when it gets a key press, what to do with it. But So the hardware is running the OS's code, so that code could do whatever the OS decides it wants to do. Does that answer your question? So they can make a decision, hopefully, or about it. Yeah?
So how would the answer change if it was a 3-core OS?
How would the answer change if it was a 3-core OS? So there would be things happening on other cores, and we need to know about them. So with a single core OS, I'm telling you what happens in one core. But if we had 3 cores, those other cores could also have exceptions be happening. And things doing making exceptions happen or not. I mainly mentioned it was single core. So when I said the OS runs B, it was clear that it ran on the same processor. And when it runs C, it was clear that it needed to switch from B to C, that it couldn't like run them on 2 different cores at once. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes?
How is A context
switching to B not an exception? So as I mentioned, when A waits to read the key press, maybe I probably should... This whole thing is an event which has one exception that results in a whole lot of things happening. So A waits to read key press, that causes B to run. And that's one thing the hardware does, is run the OS to do that. Whole process. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So B running while A is waiting isn't an exception.
So question, B running while A is waiting is not the exception. Yes, the exception is triggered because A wanted to ask the OS to wait. And the way the OS implemented that functionality is by running B. That's how the OS satisfied A's request. Yeah?
So if there's 5 programs that run one after each other, and that's on one single core, then that must be 5 exceptions.
So question, if 5 programs run after each other, then there must be 5 exceptions. So I would say it's 4 exceptions. Each transition from one program to the other requires an exception to happen because we need to access for which things. Yes? Other questions? Little behind here, so next time we'll start by talking a little about XP6, which I did in the morning lecture, but that's okay, and then going into how system calls work in a bunch more detail. Or not the morning, the 12:30 lecture, the morning-ish lecture.